Okay, so for the recording,
we're feeding back on notes taken from Act 1, Scene 1, the first couple of pages of the script that we looked at last lesson, and we're linking that to the themes that we've been exploring so far. And that's pretty much what we're going to do. We've got a couple more themes to go over, but we're just going to look at some of the key areas of the text and just try and link it to themes, so that in your revision notes, you've got ideas about themes, you've got text to go alongside it to use as evidence. I'm being fairly dictatorial in that I've taken you through the themes and given you ideas. That doesn't mean for a minute that you can't make your own judgments about the text. Please don't assume that anything that I say is right because I've said it. Consider it, think about it. Use me as a critic. Right, so let's have a look. We look from Act 1, Scene 1, line 35, meantime we shall express, or just before that, actually, 32, attend the Lords of France and Burgundy. So just at random, in no particular order, some of the things you picked out and some of the things that you said. Shall I, Lawrence, I'll start with you?
When Cordelia says nothing, my lord,
okay.
That's the direct violation of what her father's wishes were, which would have been the people would have been horrifying at the time because you had to respect your parents and all their wishes.
Good. Absolutely. So her very blunt nothing. And people worry about AO2 when we come to Shakespeare. How do I comment on Shakespeare's language? Well, in exactly the same way you would comment on language in any text. That is blunt, isn't it? The tone is blunt. It's defiant almost. She uses the term of respect, my lord. Nothing, my lord. But actually, it becomes almost mocking, doesn't it? Given that what she's saying, nothing, my lord. Good. And that links to the theme of how a daughter would be expected to behave. Not only a daughter, but don't forget she's got two roles here. She's daughter and she's also subject to the king. Both of those reasons are very good reasons for her to be respectful and obedient, and she's not. Good. What else did you pick out, Megan? So you picked out. Write your notes first.
I said, when Goron says, beyond Rockmead Valley, Butchore, it shows she has the obedience towards her father. The other daughters didn't, because they, as soon as he said they loved him, he gave them land. They
yes.
forgot about him, they abandoned him, but Goron didn't.
Goneril didn't abandon them?
No, she did.
Okay, so that actually raises a different point, because Goneril's speech, it kind of exemplifies exactly how a daughter might be expected to feel about her father. Kind of the utter devotion. Don't forget her father owned his daughter until she became someone else's wife. So when she says, if I can find it, I love you more than word can wield the matter, dearer than eyesight, space and liberty, beyond what can be valued, rich or rare, no less than life with grace, health, beauty, honour, as much as child e'er loved or father found, a love that makes breath poor and speech unable, beyond all manner of so much, I love you. She's in a sense expressing the orthodox view, the cultural view of how a daughter should feel about her father. What's the problem with it, though? Do we believe it? We don't believe it. It almost seems overly exaggerated. The language is very rhetorical. That is language that's deliberately designed to impress and to elevate. If you look at the some of the things that she does, she uses a lot of tripling in there, the rule of three we often call it. And it was a well understood rule of rhetoric in Shakespeare's time. But if you express things in threes, then it has a certain symmetry to it, a certain power to it. So she says, dearer than eyesight, space and liberty. She uses listing, doesn't she? Another rhetorical device. No less than life, with grace, health, beauty, honour. that list that, that kind of builds in terms of how she feels about her father.
Can I leave my bag here for a bit?
Yeah. And then the last line of that speech is line 60. She says, "Beyond all manner of so much, I love you." She inverts, that is, she swaps round the grammar of that sentence, doesn't she? Or Shakespeare does it, of course, for her. Shakespeare does it, puts those words in her mouth. You would expect her to say, perhaps, "I love you beyond all manner." But what she says is, "Beyond all manner of so much, I love you." And it leaves those three monosyllabic, one-syllable words at the end of her speech to really emphasise what she said here. "I love you," she says. And it's the grammar of that sentence, the syntax. Syntax is just word order of the sentence that does all the work there. Okay, good. So in Goneril's words there, she expresses the orthodox view of how a daughter should feel, the culturally accepted view, but because it's so rhetorical, because it's so exaggerated, actually as an audience we immediately suspect that it's not true. We don't believe her. Good. What else have we got? Go on, Alex.
It's that from my good when he says, "To shape all cares and business from our age, conferring them on your strengths."
Yes.
"When we have heard who is called towards death." And then he goes on to say, "To publish our doctor to serve our doubtless."
Yeah.
I said it sort of follows the theme of nature and the way it's like structured, because he's passing on, he's willing to pass on his land to his daughters,
right,
and hope that they'd take over, but he still wants the title as king, but he's passing.
Right. Absolutely. So it touches on the theme of nature, absolutely, and it certainly touches on kind of themes of kingship and authority. We haven't looked at those specifically, but we've kind of looked at those in passing. What he's doing, of course, is effectively abdicating, isn't he? He's giving away his power. And it was well understood that a king or a queen, but normally a king's abdication, led to chaos, led to an unsettling and a difficult time. Now what he says is that he's trying to do it in order to prevent problems later. He says in order that future strife may be prevented now. But that goes absolutely against the idea of the great chain of being, the divine right of kings, because in those systems of belief and understanding, you are who you are until the moment that you die. You can't be a king for some of your life and then give it up because you're getting a bit old and you don't feel like you're up to it. If you're a king, you're a king, you're a king, and you're a king till you die, because that's your place, that's your role, that's your destiny. So although his words have a certain kind of a rationale to them, a Renaissance audience would absolutely understand the foolishness of what he's suggesting, or would feel the foolishness of what he's suggesting. Okay. Good. Just as a context note there, of course, James the First is very newly on the throne. Who did he come after?
Elizabeth.
Those of you who've done history, do you know much about the kind of latter years of Elizabeth's reign?
We should.
We should. I won't play this recording to Mr. Green, I promise.
Was she at war
with him?
Was she? Were they still at war
with him? On and off. Yeah, she was increasingly frail, but kind of kept or tried very hard to keep her image as the Virgin Queen, as the defender of Britain. And there's a classic description. I think I'm going to show you a DVD in a couple of lessons time, and I think it references it there. One of her advisors, and I can't remember which one, I can't remember his name, who happened to chance upon her in her bedroom when she wasn't made up, and realised how old she was and how frail she was. But whenever she appeared in public, she had her queen's face on, literally, towards the end, plastered on, to try and keep that sense of strength and vitality about her. The truth was, when she was, by the end of her reign, she was a very old, for the time, and frail woman, and really wasn't capable of the kind of strength that she'd shown earlier in her reign. That links directly to this, doesn't it? Because what Lear is suggesting is that because he's old, he's going to give it up. And that contrasts with Elizabeth, who fought to the end of her reign to maintain her position and to maintain her vitality. So I guess what I'm saying is that these are very relevant contextual issues that they're talking about here. Okay, good. I suppose one more context thing, I think, I hope it's obvious, but I'll say it anyway, is that obviously this idea of the succession of a monarchy is very, very recent. You know, Elizabeth died without a clear successor. Actually, the handover of power to James was relatively smooth in the end, but that question of succession was one that was very live in the later years of Elizabeth's reign. Okay, good. More quotes. Danielle, what did you get?
My mum has a nice head.
Okay, that's all right. Sophia.
To the years of the year, people say, when you preach a new year, say that love is more.
Yeah.
And he almost wants to be praised like a god.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. He his desire is to be worshipped, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
As a god is worshipped. There's some really interesting things in that quote. Which of you, shall we say, doth love us most? What's the word that stands out as being odd? Doth? Okay, so some words of... what's the word I'm looking for? Oh, dear me. Antiquity, that's not the word I'm looking for, but it'll do for now. Which of you, shall we say, doth love us most? Who's the us? Well, it should be me, shouldn't it? Because there's only one of him, and as far as we're aware, he doesn't have a wife, certainly not a wife who's still alive. He would have had a wife at some point, he has three daughters, but a wife. Now, the use of us there, the pronoun us, is what we often refer to as the royal we. And it's an ancient tradition, and monarchy will still do it, certainly the Queen will still do it. She talks about herself in plural. Us, we. Because what that represents is that she doesn't speak just for herself, but that she speaks for the government of the country, and she speaks on behalf of God. So that when the Queen, or in this case the King, speaks, they don't speak only for themselves. They speak for the office that they hold. And they speak for God, who they represent in that office. It's a sign of his status at the beginning of the play, and also his clear sense of himself as king. He and his role and his office are one, us. Now, if you contrast that and compare that to later on in the play, right at the end of the play, for example, he says, "I am a foolish, fond old man. I am a, not we are, but I am." So by the end of that play, his identity has changed significantly from the royal we to the very humble I he is at the end. But it absolutely, as Fear said, shows his pride, his arrogance, but also his foolishness. It suggests, doesn't it, that he doesn't know his daughters, if he needs to know how much they love him. Or if he does know his daughters, it suggests he's simply like a foolish child wanting to have his ego pampered by his daughters. Okay, really good. Okay, let's see what else we've got. Sarah, what else did you pick up?
I said Aaron was born to be first.
Yeah.
So it was kind of like the parents thought to think, because he's been a commandment.
Yes. Yes. He's being absolutely, there's two things to say about that, and you're absolutely right to focus on it. He is being authoritative, and his tone is imperative all the way through this. The reason I went from line 32 and not line 35 is because of his imperative commands at the start there. He says, "Attend the lords of France and Burgundy, Gloucester." And Gloucester says, "I shall, my liege." He starts with the verb to attend, means to look after. And he starts with that imperative verb, "Attend the lords of France and Burgundy, Gloucester." And his immediate response, "I shall, my liege." There's absolutely no doubt about who's in control, and Lear's language is authoritative, and the tone is imperative, that is, it's commanding. And it's exactly the same as you say there, Sarah. Our eldest born speak first. It's the same tone, isn't it? Speak first. It's also an interesting point, because he's being absolutely orthodox in his following of the great chain of being, and that he's asked the eldest born, who would be the first in line for inheritance, to speak first. It's a minor point, but one worth considering. Okay. Just a couple of other things you may or may not... Does anyone else have anything else that we haven't said yet? Rebecca, Sam, did you? What did you pick up?
I haven't got
one. Okay. Did anybody else have anything else to pick out?
Can we explain reading first?
Yes, I certainly will. Then we'll just move and look at Cordelia's speech as well, which you didn't look at yesterday. Just a couple of quick things to draw your attention to. Lear describes what he's doing as our darker purpose, and then uses the imperative command, "Give me the map there." Shakespeare's not wanting to leave us in any doubt about what Lear is doing here. Darker has a double meaning here. Darker as in more serious. It's not an implication the word has for us anymore. It's changed. But it did have that implication then. But of course, it also carries the implication of darker, sinister, evil purpose. Again, suggesting that what Lear is about to do is directly opposed to the great chain of being, divine right of kings. Okay, and then we'll look at Regan's speech. It's on line 68. She says, "I am made with that self-same metal as my sister, and prize me at her worth. In my true heart I find she names my very deed of love, only she comes too short. That I profess myself an enemy to all other joys, which the most precious square of sense possesses, and find I am alone felicitate in your dear Highness's love." Regan's speech, in a sense, is very similar to Goneril's, in that it has that same rhetorical tone to it. It's very sure of itself, the speech. She says in the first three lines, "I agree entirely with what my sister says. I am made with that self-same metal as my sister." Self-same metal, exactly the same stuff. The same, same. I'm made of the same thoughts, ideas, feelings as my sister. She describes her heart as my true heart, which is ironic given that what we find out about her later. But the use of the adjective there, again, makes that rhetorical. It elevates what she says. It's not just my heart saying this, it's my true heart saying this. It elevates it, it makes it more sincere, more emotive. On the fourth line of what she says, though, she says, only she comes too short. And again, it's a brilliant rhetorical device. She says, I feel exactly the same, only a little bit more. She comes too short. She's fallen short. That I profess myself an enemy to all other joys, which the most precious square of sense possesses, and find I am alone felicitate in your dear highness's love. You can hear the rhetorical tone, kind of has a kind of rhythm and a tone to it of a kind of persuasive speech. And what she says is that there are no other joys in her life other than her father. In fact, even more than that, anything else that would claim to be a joy is an enemy to her when compared to the love she has for her father. Now, if I was her husband standing on the sidelines here, I might be a little bit concerned by that. Except we know Regan's husband is Cornwall and he'll be cheering her on because he wants every square inch of land he can get. She says, the only thing that makes me happy is your dear highness's love. I find I am alone felicitate in your dear highness's love. We should talk a little bit about iambic pentameter. We've looked at it before. How comfortable are we with iambic pentameter? Something we need to go over? It's fine if we do. Okay. Okay, I'll tell you what we do. We won't do it now. I'll wait till everybody's here. But remind me the next lesson that we have that I need to do iambic pentameter. Let's very quickly, just for the 5 minutes that we got, have a look at Cordelia's speech. It's on line 95. This is her speech that she makes to her father after she said nothing. He said to her, he's desperate for her to do well. He said, how Cordelia, mend your speech a little, lest you may mar your fortunes. He's still gentle with her here, saying, come on, do a bit better than that. You don't want to ruin your chances here. And she turns, and this is the speech that turns him into a rage of terror, sorry, of anger. She says, good my lord, you have begot me, bred me, loved me. I return those duties back as our right fit, obey you, love you, and most honour you. Why have my sister's husbands, if they say they love you all? Happily, when I shall wed, that lord whose hand must take my plight shall carry half my love with him, half my care and duty. Sure, I shall never marry like my sisters, for love my father all. Okay, couple of questions. Is her speech any less rhetorical or any less impressive than her sister's? Do you spot the same tripling in there? The same repetition? Obey you, love you, and most honour you. The repetition of you there at the end of each of those phrases. Clauses, I think. All rhetorical devices. So Shakespeare is making it absolutely clear that Cordelia is not doing what she's doing because she's incapable of the sort of speeches that her sister's made. This isn't a case of her capability to express her love to her father. That's not an issue. And I think that's a really important thing to point out. Shakespeare's kind of thinking in Act 1 is interesting when you look at it, but what one thing he's clearly pointing out here is that Cordelia is their equal in terms of her intelligence, her ability. Copy off? Yeah, I do. I'll get one for you just in a second. I just finished this one. I'll go and get it. Actually, if you want to get one, they're on the, I think, there somewhere. What she says is, you have begot me, bred me, love me, and I return those duties back as are right fit. I obey you, love you, and most honour you. What she doesn't ever say is that I don't love you, and she never says that I don't, my duty isn't to you. What she says is, I'm refusing to do what my sisters have just done, which is to pretend that they love you all, that you're their everything. So that I have a duty to you as my father, and I'm very aware of that duty, and I will pay you that duty, return those duties back as our right fit. But she says, I'm not going to let my sisters pretend that when I get married, my husband means nothing to me and all my love is for you, my father. She says, happily, when I shall wed, that Lord whose hand must take my plight shall carry half my love with him, half my care and duty. She actually says, is when I marry, half of my love will go to my husband and half will go to my father. We might still think that's a bit odd today, might we? But that's what she says. So how does that fit into the kind of orthodox view of things? Yeah, it's right, in a sense, isn't it? And in a way, what Shakespeare's doing here, and I'm convinced that this is a kind of a deliberate thing that he's doing here, is that he's making the audience think about the way a daughter and or children and parents really should react. Because there's a kind of cultural expectation that the daughters and sons, but particularly daughters, their parents should be everything to them. There are some letters, we'll look at them when we look at some context. There were some letters written by James's daughter to him. Now, I came slightly later in his life than King Lear. Hey, come in. But nonetheless, it's that kind of idea of overflowing, of an unreasonable love, daughter to father. And Shakespeare seems to be suggesting or questioning whether that's actually right, because Cordelia's love seems perfectly reasonable, doesn't it?
But should the dog, a rat, have life and thou no breath at all?
Thank you very much. Nothing comes of nothing, you know? So Cordelia's response is actually quite reasonable. And it makes her father's response seem all the more unreasonable when he banishes her so brutally from the kingdom.